Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
You know, everybody loves tomatoes. There's a lot of varieties. Tomatoes are interesting. And I'm a pizza man. Right. So tomatoes sort of come naturally.
Jeff Meese has made a living off selling tomatoes in the form of pizza sauce. Instead of speaking with him at one of his restaurants today, we go to his farm. Cooking with tomatoes is one of the joys of late summer. Daniel Orr makes an easy dish with the tiniest of tomatoes. Then it's a succotash with another summer darling, corn. What's going on with Monsanto these days? Harvest Public Media tells us the company could be adjusting its business plan. And we take a visit to a farm in French Lick, Indiana, where using organic growing practices is way more important than getting the USDA seal of approval. An outbreak and a couple of studies to look into with Mark Chilla. First, news about how the harvest is looking.
The USDA released its first crop report of the year this week, and prices for commodity crops are not looking good, Annie. A bushel of soybeans will cost you $9.15, which is the lowest rate in 9 years. Corn and wheat prices are both tanking to 6-year lows. Ag insider Chuck Abbott reports the low prices are likely due to record-setting yields last year and unexpectedly plentiful harvests this year. On the other hand, Indiana's farmers are expected to produce significantly less corn this year thanks to massive flooding the state experienced this summer. Corn is expected to decline 20%. Soybeans should fare better, down 9%. This year brought about the second wettest June and July in Indiana's recorded history. State officials announced farmers could get assistance to make up for their losses in the form of low-interest loans through a federal disaster declaration. Researchers at Harvard crunched survey data spanning 7 years from nearly 500,000 people in China and found a small connection between longevity and how much spicy food they ate. The article published in the BMJ Journal said that people who ate spicy foods 1 or 2 days per week had a 10% decrease in their overall risk of mortality. Those who ate spicy foods 3 to 7 times per week reduced mortality risk by 14%. Liu Qi, associate professor at Harvard Medical School and the study's author, said while evidence shows it could be a good idea to add more chili to your meals, the results are far from definitive. The study highlights a correlation, but it doesn't prove cause and effect. Critics point out that eating spicy foods could just be a marker of some other important factor. People who consume spicy foods almost every day were more likely to be rural residents, for example. Critics also worry that since all of the subjects live in China, the correlation might not transfer to other parts of the world. Qi and his research team are in the early stages of planning clinical trials in China to look for stronger evidence of the connection. An update on the Cyclospora outbreak. There are now 457 confirmed cases of Cyclospora in 29 states. That's an additional 73 people and 2 more states since last week's CDC update. Investigations in Wisconsin and Texas identified cilantro as the likely culprit. And a back-to-school story as we're getting ready to welcome students to Indiana University. Over the last few years, the number of food pantries on college campuses has increased dramatically. The College and University Food Bank Alliance reports that from 2008 to 2015, the number of food pantries in their network grew from just a handful to 199. The flagging economy played a big role as low-end wages stagnated, and older students went back to school to try to boost their income. Claire Cady is the director and co-founder of CUFBA. When it comes to the image of the struggling college student, poverty might seem like a rite of passage. But that idea doesn't match up with what advocates see on the ground, where many students face serious food insecurity.
A lot of them are working full-time and still struggling. And some of them are supporting families, and a lot of them don't have parental support as financial aid. So we're not talking about sort of this Dickensian romanticized notion of working, you know, this working hard college student who, you know, maybe doesn't get to turn up the heat as much in the winter and is eating ramen. We're talking about students that truly aren't getting meals.
Katie said the number of new campus food banks is now leveling off, but members are seeing increased demand and more questions about how to tackle student homelessness. Hard data on student homelessness is scarce. Previous studies have shown a wide range of results, reporting that between 14% and 60% of students experience food insecurity. A study is underway at the California State University System to determine how many students lack food and housing. We post these stories on eartheats.org, and then we start a conversation about them on Twitter. Looking for your input at EarthEats.
Liz Leslie and Chad Bouchard write our news updates. Mark Chilla reads them. Thanks.
You bet.
Monsanto, the world's largest seed company, is attempting to swallow up the world's largest producer of pesticides. As Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon reports, the deal signals a change in focus for the agricultural giant, with ripple effects across farm country.
Welcome.
Ty Vaughn motions to what looks like a large refrigerator door at a Monsanto lab in suburban St. Louis. He's in charge of making sure the company's seeds conform to international regulations.
So in here, these are plants that we're using for demos. You probably saw some of these plants.
The room is outfitted with bright lights and mirrored walls. It's full of crops in various stages of growth, tomatoes, corn, and soybeans. For the last few decades, rooms like this have been the testing grounds for the company's game-changing and controversial genetically engineered seeds.
So I'll go ahead and close this if you're okay, because it's kind of loud.
I'm here as part of a press tour of the research campus. Lately, the corporation's been trying to explain itself to consumers, attempting to change its brand to that of a warm and fuzzy food company rather than a shadowy seed conglomerate. And it's been on a buying frenzy. Monsanto has purchased weather analysis companies and big data firms, betting that as climate change takes hold, farmers will need more technology to adapt. Vaughn says Monsanto is even looking into how drones could be deployed on farms.
Everybody's always drawn to the new shiny technologies that are coming along, right?
The company's widely known for the invention of the herbicide glyphosate, sold under the brand name Roundup. But that was discovered decades ago. And today, Monsanto lags behind in chemistry research. That's why it's trying to buy Syngenta, the largest producer of farm chemicals in the world.
Now, this has been a very unusual deal. I'm kind of used to the situation where, you know, two parties meet, you know, they argue, you usually walk out once or twice.
That's Monsanto's chief technology officer, Rob Fraley. He's speaking to me and 19 other journalists as part of a National Press Foundation program co-sponsored by the Organic Trade Association, the AARP Foundation, and Monsanto.
You know, this has been a deal that's all been played out in the public.
So far, Syngenta has rebuked Monsanto's offers. And to add insult to injury, Syngenta executives began leaking private letters between the two companies. Monsanto's proposal involves buying Syngenta's chemical operation under a larger parent company, which would sport a brand new name.
There's no getting away from the fact that Monsanto's name is tainted.
Hope Shand is a researcher with the ETC Group, a Canadian agriculture think tank.
In the minds of consumers everywhere, Monsanto personifies the evils of industrial agriculture.
Monsanto frequently shows up on lists for the most hated companies, usually somewhere towards the top. Shand says a name change is just a smart business move. Leave the Monsanto baggage behind. But whether the takeover happens or not, Shand says the large multinational corporations that produce seeds and chemicals for farms are primed to start feasting on each other, and farmers will feel it.
What we're going to see is a whole feeding frenzy among these corporations. Basically, we're talking about narrowing farmers' options.
If this is to go through, there are a lot of antitrust concerns.
Phil Howard studies corporate consolidation at Michigan State University. Monsanto argues its proposed deal wouldn't trigger an antitrust crackdown. Even if that's true, Howard says another big concern is what deals like this mean for research.
Companies are very focused on blockbuster innovations. So they put a lot of money into things that are going to give them blockbuster profits, and they ignore innovations that are needed but are not necessarily going to give them huge returns.
Back at Monsanto's research facility, Ty Vaughn says while the company's moves into chemistry, data collection, and maybe drones are broadening its focus, genetically engineered crops will remain its bread and butter.
Biotech is here to stay. We've already shown the value of biotech, and we're going to continue to have efforts into biotech. These other tools are just going to augment that.
The deal with Syngenta is far from finished. After a couple rejections, Monsanto has taken to wooing Syngenta's shareholders. A final deal is likely to come down to what Monsanto is willing to pay. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
Check out their website with more stories, videos, and audio links as well. HarvestPublicMedia.org. It is tomato season in Midwest Gardens, and Jeff Meese's tomato patch is no different. He runs various restaurants around Bloomington, and they serve a lot of tomatoes at his local pizza delivery chain and his restaurant, Lenny's. We take a visit to his farm today and spend some time in the rows of the tomato patch.
You know, everybody loves tomatoes. There's a lot of varieties. Tomatoes are interesting. And I'm a pizza man, right. So tomatoes sort of come naturally.
Meese is a gentleman farmer. I visited him last year around this time on his lush farm just outside the city. We took a walking tour around the 70 acres.
I've been gardening since I was 13 years old. And I, of course, you know, every gardener will grow tomatoes. And I used to grow a lot of tomatoes when I was young, even though I really didn't like tomatoes. Like, I would never eat a tomato. And still, to sit down and eat a whole tomato is not that appealing to me.
We make it to a 1/3-acre plot of land. Until last year, this area had been home to some pigs he keeps on the farm.
We had kept them up here, a couple young ones that we were feeding out before we slaughtered them. And we kept them in an area, and pigs are known to just really, they're rooters, so they dig up the soil and they fertilize it, obviously. So we planted a garden in this spot where we had had pigs.
Tomatoes, as far as I can see.
Right, we've got tomatoes. So we've got about a little under 800 tomato plants in this area, and we really do it for fun. I mean, we are selling the tomatoes to the restaurant at a typical wholesale price, and we're hoping this can grow.
That's right. He's selling his tomatoes he's growing on his farm to his restaurant, Lenny's. The restaurant buys these at the regular wholesale price so that he's not undercutting other local producers. For Meese, this farm and the produce he's growing isn't necessarily about getting a deal.
It's not about that. It's more about raising something that's unique to your place, unique to the area, something that, say, only is available to your restaurant, so that there's a story behind it.
His story is that he opened a chain of pizza delivery restaurants in 1982. He had worked as a delivery guy for Domino's and thought he could open a local business that would give the corporate guy a run for his money. The original Pizza X location is right next to the Indiana University campus. It was successful then and still is today. He opened a casual dining restaurant in the same complex in 1989. That's Lenny's. Today, he also owns a craft brewery, a catering business, and a commissary kitchen, where other small food businesses around the area can prep their food in a commercial space. Meese admits that the majority of the food his businesses sells comes from non-local sources. But what makes his business different is he is local. He's able to communicate the value of those local tomatoes to his customers.
If I'm going to dine this way, I want meaning, for one thing. I want understanding. I'd like to know where this food is coming from. I want to know that you, the restaurateur, through the value chain, are giving me your best.
And that, he says, is the cornerstone of the farm-to-table movement. Back in the tomato patch at Lush Farm, the plants almost look like grapevines the way they're growing.
This style of trellising is called the Florida weave. And what we've done is sink 5/8-inch rebar, 10-foot stakes every 10 or 12 feet. And we plant a double row of tomatoes down in between them. And they're set. The rows are set 12 feet apart, so we could easily put a big cart down the middle. And then in between the rows, you see I've planted clover for nitrogen. Clover is a nitrogen fixer, and really you see how lush it is in between these. Much better to do this than to just leave the ground bare.
This is the 8th year Meese's farm has produced food.
It's probably going to be another 7 years before we're actually doing anything commercial out here. Just have slowly, kind of organically, letting the vision for what we're going to do out here take shape. And so we want to do it once, do it right.
Jeff Meese has been doing it right in Bloomington, Indiana since the early 80s. He's a restaurateur, a businessman, and a farmer. He also raises water buffalo. We did a story on the cutest and sassiest member of his herd last year. Definitely seek that out at eartheats.org. Just search for Shadow. Now let's cook with tomatoes with Chef Daniel Orr in his mom's kitchen in Columbus, Indiana.
We've got our cherry tomatoes as well as a couple heirloom varieties. We've got our basil here. And what we're going to do is do some burst cherry tomatoes. And what that means is we're going to put some really hot oil in a pan, add the cherry tomatoes until the skins start to burst off of them, then we'll add the rest of the ingredients, and then you could use it for all kinds of things. You could use it on top of a toasted bread for kind of a crostini. You could throw it over pasta. You could serve it over some sautéed kale. But this is a nice way that you can use the summer bounty of cherry tomatoes. We are going to use some decent quality olive oil here. We're going to add our tomatoes. We're going to add some garlic. Now we're going to let that go until it gets a little toasty and brown. And you can see the skins of the tomatoes are starting to burst. We're going to add a little bit of lemon zest. Be careful with the smoke alarm going off.
Crisis averted. And we're back.
I'm just going to tear up the basil. You don't want to chop basil much because it bruises it. This way it retains more of its flavor. I'm going to toss that and then finish it with some Parmesan cheese. So you have this wonderful tomato compote. And I'm just going to pour that out onto this tart shell. Now you could use toast, you could use baguette. And that makes a perfect little starter for your next summer dinner party.
Find this recipe, and it is a good one, at eartheats.org. In the second half today, Michael Hicks' farm was once certified organic, but not anymore.
I think it's still better to have the system, but it's really set up for large farms. I mean, we grow a lot of food, but we're still a small, like, family-sized farm.
More from him next. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. It's Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Organic has become one of those buzzwords we hear all the time. Organic produce, organic cooking, organic shopping. Student reporter Jamie Ordonez has a story of a farmer who embraces the organic ideal but dismisses the formal USDA certification process.
Living Roots is a farming eco-village in French Lick, Indiana. Home to about 10 farmers at a time, they produce tons and tons of produce each year. So what exactly is organic? The dictionary says it's, quote, of, relating to, or derived from living matter. And Michael, farming manager of Living Roots, says,
when you're organic, you're trying to, like, work with the land and you're trying to work with nature versus, like, conventional. Conventional is really trying to control nature.
The USDA, however, only lets you call yourself organic if you go through their certification process. But to Michael and the rest of Living Roots, you don't have to be certified to be organic. So when Michael or I just say organic, I mean the non-USDA kind. If I'm talking about the USDA definition, I'll say certified organic. Since technically we aren't supposed to be using the big O word, Michael plays with terminology.
What's a word you'd use to describe your farm?
I mean, most people just say chemical-free, or some people say natural, but natural is really even more deflated than organic, so I don't really like using natural. Yeah, most people say, or eco-grown, you can use that term.
So to him, it's not so much the term that's important, but rather the process the farmer uses.
That's as much a part of being organic in my mind as not using chemicals or mm-hmm. whatever. It's the process and like how much petroleum you're using, the sustainability of it.
Michael wasn't always dedicated to this lifestyle. He co-founded Living Roots 3 years ago after completely changing his life path. First, he got a business degree and then got a job in an industry that he now loathes. Big corporate chemical.
And then I was just like, really start asking the question of like, what's my bigger purpose here? What's going to fulfill me in my life? And like, it's not sitting at a desk doing being an accountant for a big chemical corporation that I was working for. And then so I just started asking the question, and it took a long time.
And now his professional life is completely chemical free. This idea of life fulfillment is something Michael and the rest of the Living Roots community focuses on, and it stretches beyond farming.
We'll have like a lot of artist people come and creative kind of people that don't want like a corporate work environment, and they can do their own thing. So it is about creating an umbrella here that where people can do what they love to do.
And as for Michael, he knows he's found his place at Living Roots. Back to this whole organic thing. So they believe in this completely. They farm organic, live organic, everything organic, but they choose not to be certified. Here is why.
You have to write down basically like all your pounds of harvest for like each vegetable, and you have to write down your sales of harvest for each vegetable, and you have to write everything you put in your fields, and it just goes a little bit too far.
Michael knows this firsthand. He used to be certified, but stopped because he became disenchanted with the process. Another reason he turned away from certification is that he believes organic should focus on the soil, but the USDA doesn't even test the soil for chemicals.
I mean, organic really focuses on soil, and it's, you know, when you're focusing on the soil, you can plant in different ways. And we're also like, our methods of harvesting are much more organic. It's not like you're just taking big tractors and harvesting with tractors. We're harvesting with people, and so we can plant in smaller spaces.
Not being certified hasn't hindered Living Roots' success. They have over 100 families that pick up produce on a weekly basis, sell at various farmers markets, and deliver their produce to local restaurants. So if you can be so successful without being certified, why does the system exist?
I think it's still better to have the system, but it's really set up for large farms. I mean, we grow a lot of food, but we're still a small, like, family-sized farm. And so, yeah, it's set up for, like, you know, shipping organic produce, certified organic produce across the country where you can't meet your farmer. So, like, most of our customers, they know our practices are really organic and that's the kind of farming we do.
For WFIU's Earth Eats, I'm Jamie Ordonez.
This story was a collaboration with Earth Eats and the Indiana University School of Journalism.
Mike, can you get me a butternut squash?
Now with Chef Orr in his professional kitchen, Farm Bloomington, he's making a succotash today with lots of summer veggies. Go ahead and grab a young butternut squash from your garden, too.
Back in the heart of the kitchen, where it's very warm.
Yeah, we call this the piano. That's the stove. And our piano's a little bit messy right now. We had lots of eggs going this morning.
In comes butternut squash.
Usually when you're cooking butternut squash, you're cooking it a long time, and it's all smashy and mushy, and usually you're putting a lot of maple syrup and stuff on it. This way we're going to use it, leave it more crunchy, almost like have the texture of a kernel of corn. So we're going to cut it into a kind of a small dice, and this is a fairly quick recipe because all these vegetables are small, so it won't take a long time to cook. We've got half cup of unsalted butter, and what we're doing is kind of making the with some onions and garlic, we're making the foundation of the succotash. All right, so we got that butter melting, and again, it looks, a half cup of butter seems like a lot of butter, but this is going to feed 6 to 8 people, and it's meant to be kind of one of those rich, hearty vegetable dishes. All right, our onion is and garlic are starting to melt. You want them to become translucent. Onions are always a sweetening agent kind of in a dish. They have a lot of sugar in them, and so what you're doing is you're evaporating the water out of the onion, and then you're intensifying that sugar. So when you cook things, we're going to cook it translucent. That means you're going to kind of be able to see through them a little bit, but we aren't going to caramelize them, which would mean that we were going to color the onions. So we want to keep this fairly blonde or light in color. So now that these are nice and translucent, we're going to start adding our other vegetables. We've got that butternut squash. We've got some corn. Nice baby lima beans, which I love. Some diced red pepper for color. So these are right out of our homestead gardens down in Gibson County in Indiana. You know, I love these things right out of the garden because they have so much more kind of personality. You can see this one looks like some kind of a wrinkly old lion or something.
Yeah, and it's two-toned.
And it's two-toned. So, you know, that's the fun about using local produce is I think it's got more flavor, it's better for you, and then also just more fun to look at. Okay, we're going to dice up that pepper, again, about the same size as a kernel of corn or a baby lima bean. Okay, another ingredient that we're adding to this autumn succotash are some local mushrooms. We're using some pink oyster mushrooms. All right, so we're going to stir these in, and you can see you've got these nice different shapes and colors. And as that starts to cook down, we're going to splash in some heavy cream, which is not traditional in a succotash, but at farm we like to ramp things up, make them a little more rich and satisfying. I also like a little bit of tarragon, some beautiful fresh sage here.
And this is all fresh. These are not dried herbs.
Right. I like to use tons of fresh herbs and just a very little bit of dried herbs because dried herbs don't have that kind of real freshness. And when I'm eating a dish, I like to have, when I bite into it, I like to taste that tarragon in one leaf and kind of taste the sage in another bite. Whereas with the dried herbs, it kind of dissipates and goes throughout the whole dish more. So fresh herbs are always the way to go if you can. Okay, so you can see we don't want to overcook this. The cream is starting to thicken a little bit. I'm going to season it with some salt and pepper.
Tasting as we go.
Tasting as we go. It's getting there. I'm going to add a little more salt. I think we got it. Let's get out of this heat and go in the dining room and taste it.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, so good. And colorful and hearty. See it, make it, tell us how you like it. EarthEats.org. Thanks to our crew who helps make Earth Eats happen. Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Betsy Shepherd, and everyone at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Blooming Foods, locally grown since 1976, offering bushels of locally sourced products throughout all its locations. Bloomingfoods.coop. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Thanks for being here. I'm Annie Corrigan for Earth Eats.